Welcome to the last of three lectures, three sessions here, where we're exploring the space between mysticism and rationalism in the thought of some of the great rabbis of Prague. Tonight we arrive at the third chief rabbi of Prague in a row, and it's just partially the series is structured around these three because it's just remarkable that you had these three thinkers one after another assume the role of chief rabbi of Prague. They held different roles in Prague, but I believe they were all in some ways the Rav of Prague at some point. And that is tonight's thinker is Rabbi Yeshaya Horowitz, who we refer to as the Shla. The Shla represents in our exploration a bit of a departure from what we've seen so far, a literal departure, actually, because though the Shla was actually born in Prague, which is not true for the other two thinkers, he does something also that the other two thinkers did not do, which is that he eventually emigrates to the Holy Land and lives in Jerusalem and is very quickly taken on as the Ashkenazi kind of leader, a rabbi, rabbinic leader in Jerusalem, eventually makes his way to Tzfat, the holy city of Tzfat, which we spoke a lot about in the first session, and is buried in Tiberia, in Tiberias. So he really, like, all the holy cities. And so he actually went to that other great center of Jewish mysticism in the 1500s and 1600s, Tzfat. And that's a literal physical manifestation of what is also true about the Shla in style and in content. He is also a departure from the mysticism of Prague, particularly the mysticism of the Maharal of Prague, who we'll use as a kind of contrast point tonight, because the mysticism of Prague, as we have been trying to map it out, is distinct from the mysticism of Tzfat and the Arizal and what we come to call Kabbalah, like Kabbalah. That's not just mysticism, that's a certain received tradition that trades in certain concepts and references certain works. With the Shla, the Kabbalah becomes explicit. He is a student of Kabbalah. He has embraced that world, that tradition of Kabbalah that I was just making reference to, and his major work, the Shla, what he is known for here. I like showing the book, so I will show. This is the Shla. This is Shla, which is the acronym for Shnei Luchot HaBrit, the two tablets of the covenant. Okay, that's the name of the book. And it is, and you can see how big it is, it is an encyclopedic work on all of Judaism through the prism of Kabbalah. So he accepts and celebrates the classic masters of Kabbalah, by which I mean, for him in particular, those masters are especially Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, who was before the Arizal, the great master in Tzfat of Jewish mysticism. And before him, and another thinker that the Shla cites a lot is Rabbi Meir Ibn Gabai, another Kabbalistic thinker a bit earlier who is lived in Spain. So those two he cites a lot, but also he cites, remember, this is he lives at the same time or afterwards, but in the same period. So the Arizal has not become what the Arizal since became, which is the sort of dominant figure, the ultimate authority in matters of Kabbalah. But he does cite the Arizal in his work and calls him the last master. You know, like there are these Kabbalistic masters, and he acknowledges the Arizal has become the last master of Kabbalah, but it hasn't yet become so clear that the Arizal's Kabbalah is going to be as dominant as it is. So what he's trying to do is summarize the whole of Kabbalistic thought, and he does so with long citations. I've rarely seen a work like this where he will go on for pages and pages and pages, sometimes quote almost an entire book in his book, but it'll be a short, like, pamphlet. But he will quote the whole essay. And that's part of what he's trying to do, is to actually give you the resources. He wants you to see the material. He wants you to know the hidden material. He wants you to see what those concepts are. Here is how he begins. First, l'shem yichud kudsha brichu, for the purpose of the unification of the Holy Blessed One, u'shchinte, and his shchina, al yideahu tamir v'ne'alam baruch Hashem la'olam, through the one who is secret and hidden, praised is God forever. Okay. Now, that sounds like just a flourish to open up. We might have heard such a flourish before, l'shem yichud kudsha brichu, but it's a particular flourish which is distinct to the Kabbalistic tradition, that same tradition that filters its way from Spain into Tzfat. And I believe the book Reshit Chochma, for those who are interested, is the first book to start talking about this particular practice, which is to try with all of your actions and your intentions to bring about the unification of God. And God's unification is somehow requires us to make that unification manifest. And here, the Zohar is really coming into play. That unification also has something to do with the unification of God, the Holy One, with the male pronoun, and Shekhinah, God's presence, with the female pronoun. And the Zohar is really obsessed with that unification of the male force of God and the female force of God in some kind of cosmic, you know, union, right? So that very reference, allusion, just the Maharal doesn't start his book that way. The Kli Yakar doesn't start his book that way. That's a distinctly Kabbalistic reference and move, and that already tells you something about where the Shla is coming from. And then the very next thing that he quotes, actually the very first thing he quotes, if you just say that the L'shem is like an intention, the first thing he quotes is a very well-known verse. Kiner mitzvah v'torah or v'derech chayim tochachot musar. For the commandment or the mitzvah is a lamp or a candle maybe, and the Torah is a light, and ethical rebukes are a way of life. Okay, this is a very commonly cited verse by both our sages, Chazal, like the rabbis of the Talmud and Midrash, and the medieval rabbis, the Rishonim as well. This verse is like, it's a classic verse in thinking about ethical behavior. And the verse, as the Shla will explain, Shla will first give the very basic understanding of this verse. And he says, Pshata Pasuk, the simple understanding of the verse, is that the commandment is like a lamp to give off light in front of you. As it is written, the commandment of the Eternal is, here's another verse, Mitzvat Hashem bara, is lucid, is clear, making the eyes light up. Whereas the Torah is a light to those who study it, but the fool walks in darkness. And then you'll see an ellipses here. And those two things seem fairly easy to explain, but he goes on for a long time to explain the third part, which is that derech chayim tochachot musar, ethical rebukes are a way of life. And he goes and explains how this is a reference essentially to the centrality of musar, of not just observing the commandments and studying the Torah, but also working on your own character and your ethical behavior and trying to develop yourself morally, okay? So, and note that where the Shla is starting, even this word pshat, the simple understanding of the verse, he starts there and gives you the simple, the basic understanding of the verse, which is that here's what's important. Here's what we're going to be talking about. Here's the verse I want to start my whole book with. Mitzvot, halacha, Jewish law and practice, Torah, the study of the Torah, our Torah, not hidden materials, Kabbalistic texts and concept, but our Torah, and then Musar, you know, like ethical self-work, discipline, moral behavior, that kind of the realm of the self and self-development according to basic principles, the basic principles, the ethics, the values that underlie our tradition and the attempt to live life in line with God. Doesn't sound like anything too mystical about that. That's just, those are just the basics, aren't they? Those are the fundamental, the classic categories of Jewish religious life, okay? So now, I want to just highlight that he starts with a Kabbalistic incantation, so to speak, and then quickly moves to a verse that has very basic Judaism 101 fundamentals and names those fundamentals, spends time naming those fundamentals, and that's important. But, he says, and here he begins to get into the hidden dimension, which will be his main focus. But one may also answer, there's a big ellipses here, so I'm skipping a lot. But one may also answer, Odiesh Letaretz, in another more internal way, Yoter Pnimi. HaTorah hi ma'aseh ve'iyuni. The Torah is action and analysis, revealed and hidden. Here's that pairing that I mentioned at the outset. We're going to see this a lot. Nigleh ve'nistar, revealed and hidden. Okay? And these words are in the passive tense, right? As I'm trying to indicate here in the English. That which is revealed, so what's the revealed? That which is revealed in the Torah is the practice of its commandments. Hu kiyum mitzvoteha. And all the commandments that you, the 248 positive commandments and the guarding of the negative commandments, the prohibitions, the 365 negative commandments, okay? That's the revealed layer of the Torah because we get the laws, we do them. But for each of these, le'ela u'le'ela, the negative and the positive commandment, all the commandments, yesh ta'amim nistarim, there are hidden reasons, divine secrets that are all attached to God's great name. And those who know them, it is said in Psalms, I will elevate them for they know my name, and in them the verse is fulfilled, v'atem hadvekim b'Hashem lokechem, and you who cling to Hashem, your God. Okay, so the idea then is that this book is here to tell you the reasons, the deeper meaning behind the practice of the mitzvot, the normative Jewish life halacha. Okay, he's going to be discussing Jewish practice, but he suggests it's important also to know the reasons behind the practice. And those reasons are sometimes hidden from us, but it's important to know them. They shouldn't be hidden. In a sense, it's important to know them because it is by fulfilling the commandments, but also by knowing the purpose behind the commandments that one comes to know God and be able to attach oneself to God. Okay? So here we have the kind of the first pass at the dichotomy between that which is hidden and that which is revealed. And it turns out the hidden is just information we need about the revealed. It's information that will inform, that will give meaning and purpose and explanation to the revealed. Okay? So that's where the Shla begins. Now, where does the Shla go from here? Exactly to the categories that we have named. Torah, mitzvot, Torah, and Musar. And so the Shla is a work which has halachic discussions, has commentary on biblical narrative, the whole Torah, and not only the whole Torah, but the Talmud as well. Long interpretations of the Talmud. All of them, the classic works of Judaism, the classic practices of Judaism, all of them with an explanation of the hidden layer behind, the Kabbalistic layer behind Jewish practice. Okay, and that's true. I mean, it's hard to even, I could start naming other sections of the book, like a whole section on the Hebrew letters and a whole section on classic virtues and values in Judaism, but all of which are the basics of Judaism explained with its background of some hidden layer that is now being revealed. Okay, and that brings me to the passage in the Shla that I think is most important in thinking about this dichotomy between the hidden and the revealed. The whole idea that there are things which are hidden, and we saw this from the first session. The Maharal was already talking about the things which are hidden and the things which could be investigated. We've been interested in hidden matters all along, but here we're going to get a very particular explanation of what the relationship is between the hidden and the revealed. And the explanation will, I think, be unique, will be distinct from the approach that we've seen so far. So let's take a look now. This passage is the passage I most want to share with you tonight. And also, this passage I haven't gotten to it yet, I'm scrolling, is a passage that I think will help us close this series of investigations that we have been taking, because here we will get a really distinct theory of the relationship between the rational and the mystical, the hidden and the revealed. Okay, now look at how he begins here. First of all, the Shlah loves threes. He loves to link up, make connections in general, and to link up, you know, three corresponding units. Notice that he started here with the commandment, the Torah, and ethical rebuke. So those are three things. And then in the ellipsis that I pointed out here, he links these three principles with other verses, other principles, other threes, other triads. So you'll just have to trust me on that. But eventually, he gets to this point where he actually does quite a remarkable thing, which is that he says, Hare Gimel Sharashim, these same three roots, Vehem Gimel Ikarim Sheharav Bal Ikarim Yasad Sifro. These are the same three principles that the Bal HaIkarim, who is Rav Yosef Albo, established in his book. Now, Rav Yosef Albo is a medieval Jewish philosopher, one of the classics, you know, not maybe, you know, number one of the classics, not Maimonides level, but if you're interested in medieval Jewish philosophy, this work is significant, and it's called the Sefer HaIkarim, the Book of Principles, because the project of the book is to try to boil Judaism down to its essential, most essential principle. What are the main principles in that can summarize everything that Judaism is? Just as Maimonides came up with 13 principles, and those became more famous, the Sefer HaIkarim, Rav Yosef Albo, boiled it down even further to three principles. And sort of famous in this book for saying that all Judaism can be boiled down to three basic truths, and they are the existence of God, Torah from heaven, and reward and punishment. Mitziyut Hashem Yitbarach, Torah min Hashemayim, Schar Va'onesh. Okay? And you can see how these principles do or could roughly match up with his, like, where is mitzvot here in the reward and punishment category? Where is Torah study? It's in Torah from heaven. Where is working on yourself so that you can come to be in relationship with God, the existence of God? So that's an interesting move. Like I said, he likes making these connections, but it's an interesting move to suddenly suggest that even medieval rationalist Jewish philosophers were also tuned into these three principles. I'm in the tradition, I may be citing the traditions of Kabbalah, but I'm in the tradition of medieval Jewish philosophy as well. Or more to the point, that tradition is part of the whole tradition. Okay. And to make that point even more striking, take a look at the Shlah's next move here. This just brings a smile to my face, this kind of connection. To move from Rav Yosef Albo, who is not, like I said, a classic medieval Jewish philosopher, but not the first one that you would mention, and to say the following. These three roots require a thorough investigation to get the bottom of God's intention, which is to demonstrate to the nations the work of God, the great and awesome, through the essence and quality of the human being. Now, that's in itself quite a potent phrase, to demonstrate to the nations the work of God, the great and the awesome, through the essence and quality of the human being. How will that happen? Okay. And remember, he's saying these three principles are helping us get there. How are they helping us get there? And here he says, Ukvar huskaru gimel eile bezohar. These three principles have already been mentioned in the Zohar. Okay, now, I mentioned a long way, there's some debate where academics tend to think that the Zohar is a medieval text that was sort of written as if it were an earlier text, whereas the traditional Jewish world has generally accepted the Zohar as an early but maybe hidden midrash. So part of what the Shlah is saying here is that, yes, Rav Yosef Albo boiled Judaism down to three principles, but those three principles go all the way back, and they are found in the Jewish mystical tradition, and they are found in the Zohar. And then he brings us to this passage, which is a very important passage in the Zohar. It's one to remember, and I'll talk about it a little bit more, but let's take a look at it. Okay, these principles have already been mentioned in the Zohar, as well as how they are tied together and united. Mekusharim u'miyachadim. And this is a wondrous passage, which we will explain with God's good hand guiding us. And after it is explained, The door will be opened to the three gates mentioned above, and in every gate one enters to find many rooms filled with knowledge, okay? And this is the language of the Zohar, okay? So first of all, the Shlach himself names three categories, the Torah, Mitzvot, Musar, commandments, Torah, and ethics. He says those same principles can be found in medieval Jewish philosophy conversations about the essence of Judaism. And the Zohar has its formulation of it. And this is the language of the Zohar in Parshat Achremot. Taninan, Gimel Dargin Inun, Itkashrin Dabada. It is taught there are three levels which are all connected to one another. Kuchabrichu, Oraita, Visral. The Holy Blessed One, Torah, and Israel. The Zohar here actually says there are three different things which are connected, and here's the part that the Shlach will be interested in, v'cholchad darga v'darga, satim v'galya. And each one of these things has two levels, hidden and revealed. The Holy Blessed One is darga al darga. The Holy Blessed One is level upon level, satim v'galya, hidden and revealed. Torah is also level upon level, hidden and revealed. And Israel is also level upon level. As it is written, God speaks words to Jacob, rules and ordinances to Israel. Magid dvarav liYaakov, chukav umishpatav liYisrael. Now this is a great, the Zohar, along with being the central text of Jewish mysticism, is also just a great midrashic reader of verses, which is part of why the Kli Yakar likes the Zohar. But in this case, the reading is to say God speaks just words to Jacob, but speaks rules and ordinances to Israel. Jacob is the kind of the lower level and just the basic level where you're just in conversation with God. But once you advance to the higher level, to the Israel level, then suddenly a revelation happens and you are given rules and ordinances. You are given. So there's actually a reading of this verse here that we, Israel, are composed of a Jacob level and an Israel level. And one is hidden and one is revealed. The Israel level was something that was hidden at first. Okay? He was born Jacob. Okay. Okay. So what do we have here so far? Three different units, three important units, which remember, the Shlach is saying these are the three kind of central principles to be contemplating when we survey Jewish tradition, which is God, Torah, and Israel. Okay. And the Zohar says they're all connected. And then the Zohar says, though, that they're also, each one of them has two levels, hidden and revealed. And that's what the Shlach is really going to seize upon here as he continues and explains. And this, I think, is where he gets to just a remarkable statement that I think is like really the punchline, if you will, of tonight. But what, he starts by asking, what new thing are we learning in this piece? I mean, okay, so these are three big principles. I mean, he seems to think they're everywhere, so it's not such a big deal to say that they're everywhere. Who does not know that the blessed God is revealed and hidden? Like, on the one hand, it sounds like you're trading in secrets when you say there's a hidden layer, but, you know, the truth is, of course God is hidden and revealed. Nistar mitzad mahuto, hidden in God's essence, v'nigle mitzad pu'lotav, and revealed in God's actions. Like, just, you know, this is just basic Judaism. God was revealed at Mount Sinai. God was revealed at, you know, the plagues in Egypt. We don't pretend we understand what God actually is. That's hidden. But, you know, God makes manifest in the world in certain ways through God's actions, and everybody knows that. Okay, I don't know if everybody knows that, but he's saying it's not such a big chiddush. Okay. And similarly, if you want to look at the other levels, same thing with the Torah. It's not so, I mean, the Kli Yakar was speaking in this language. So too with the Torah, the idea that it has Niglev and Nistar, a revealed and hidden aspects, that's something that's known to even a first day student. Afilu bar bei rav dechad yoma. Now, I'm not sure that a first day student knows that, but he's dismissing it as something that, you know, everybody has an intuitive sense that there are things that are more hidden and there are things that are more revealed. What is the Zohar's point here that all of these three central principles have a hidden and revealed later? Doesn't everything, in a sense, have a hidden and revealed later? But certainly the majestic things like Torah and God. Okay, and here he says what I have been sort of building up towards. He says something I think very distinct and important. But what the author is making known to us, Hodia lanu bal ha-ma'amar shehanigle hu hanistar, is that the revealed is the hidden. The revealed is the hidden. For, and here's his logic, okay? His logic is, for it is precisely the revealing of that which has been hidden. Dahinu gilui ha-hester v'hishpatuto hu hanigle. The revealing of that which has been hidden and its spreading outward, that constitutes the revealed. So we find that the revealed is the hidden. Okay? Now, let me just, I just want to say that again because that's an important moment and I don't want us to miss it. We have been talking so far about two separate realms. There's the hidden layer and then there's the revealed layer. What is the relationship between these? And maybe the realms are the spiritual and the physical, the supernatural and the natural, the explicit Torah and the secret layer of Torah. That they're these two realms. Are they totally separate? Which is more important? How do we access the hidden layer? Should we access the hidden layer? The Shla, whose whole project is to give us access to the hidden layer, is saying now that, and he's saying it in the name of the Zohar, that, as if to say, this is part of the Kabbalistic tradition, to tell you that the hidden and the revealed are just two parts of the same thing. Right, there is in the hidden, or I should say, in our experience of revealed knowledge, of the things that we know. And what are the things we know? Jewish law, Jewish practice, Jewish narrative. In those things, the hidden layer of those things is in there, and it's a part of those things. They are continuous. They are one and the same, and it's only that which is not yet revealed that seems to us to be still hidden, but our job is to reveal it. Our job is to seek out the explanations behind the commandments, okay? So this kind of integration, this sort of, this idea that there is a through line between the world of secrets, the world of mystical experience, the world of Kabbalistic theology, and the very basic fundamentals of everyday normative mainstream Jewish lore and law, right? Story and practice. All of those things are part of the same system, okay? All of those things can be integrated, and the project of his book is to try to integrate them. Okay, so this, I want to now start to come to a close here and to try to draw a comparison to the Maharal, because I think a comparison and a contrast to the Maharal of Prague. But before I do that, let's just finish the piece here that I think I've arrived at the most important and I think defining statement here in the Shla, which is that the hidden is the revealed, and it's just the spreading outward of the hidden that leads to the revealed. And I just want to just so we have a little bit more exposure to the Shla in front of us, I wanted to show you how he ends this point, because he ends it both beautifully and again with a citation that is just a demonstration of how comprehensive he wants this interconnected picture of Judaism to be. And here he says, remember, the hidden is the revealed. This is hinted out in the verse. And there's a verse in Proverbs, Tepuche Zahav b'mishkiot kesef, davar daber al ofanav, like apples of gold plated with silver is a word well said. Okay, that's a verse from Proverbs. But what's striking about the verse is, why would golden apples be plated with silver? Isn't Isn't gold better than silver? Okay, so says the Shla, that is, just as silver is close to gold, just on a lower level, meaning it's basically the same thing. It's all precious metal. We care about it all. There's just an exalted precious metal, which is gold, and then there's silver, which we still love and value. So is the revealed with respect to the hidden. In other words, we should be pursuing esoteric knowledge. We should be looking for the reasons behind it all. We should be trying to get mystical knowledge, but we're just trying to get to, you know, more preciousness, more just the higher and higher levels, deeper and deeper understandings of what is already revealed, and we'll reveal that and we'll keep going. And he says many times, and what I am revealing is only the tiniest drop of what we will never know everything, but certainly our goal is to continue to try to reveal. And then he does this thing. I said there's a kind of a delightful, a curious citation at the end, which is that he quotes, of all people, Maimonides in the Guide to the Perplexed, the ultimate sort of work of rational Judaism. He says this is very similar to what Maimonides says. And Maimonides does say something similar. He quotes that same verse, like apples of gold plated with silver, and says it's an incredible metaphor. And Maimonides says that means that there is a revealed and a hidden, and that the revealed must be as good as silver, but the inner must be better than the... I'm actually not going to read this whole thing because I just, you know, I don't want to overload us with text to analyze. Right, for right now, I just want to point out what has happened, which is that the Shla has started with a less well-known medieval Jewish philosopher, not obscure, but like not one you would have expected a Kabbalist to pull out of his back pocket, moved to the Zohar, and then interpreted that Zohar and shows that Maimonides, the arch-rationalist of Judaism, says basically the same thing, right? As if to say, it's not just that halakha, that Jewish law and Torah study can be integrated with Kabbalah, but actually all of Judaism can be integrated. Like all of the great thinkers, we can synthesize everything and start to understand how everybody was reaching for this hidden layer of knowledge. Everybody was everyone was reaching for hiddenness, but everyone was also grappling with the same basic fundamental Jewish pillars of the existence of God, the revelation of the Torah from heaven, and the attempt to live a life that is just and ethical and obedient to the mitzvot, and to receive, you know, goodness and reward for that and punishment for not doing that. Okay, so that's the quote from Maimonides. And I just that movement is incredible. It's really that one line in the middle where he says that the hidden is the revealed that I want to lay particular emphasis upon. But just to see him work with all these sources and to sort of to have them at the tip of his fingers and to suggest they are all essentially connected, and I can show you how they are all connected, that's very unique to the powers, the dexterity, the virtuosity is the word I'm looking for, of the Shla here. And then he ends. After the Maimonides quote, he adds one more line, and this line just kind of blows me away. So this is, I just want to end our journey with the Shla with this line. He says, Maimonides said the same thing, and he quotes it, and then it says, you know, that's it. Ad kan l'shono, that's the end of the quote from The Guide to the Perplexed. And then he says, V'chen hanigle ha'adam hu midugmat nistar. And so it is that what's revealed in a human being is a reflection of what is hidden. So it is for us. And the reflection, I'm translating the word dugma. Dugma might be today precisely translated as an example or a model. But I just tried to make the wording here smoother. What is revealed in the human being is a reflection, is modeled on what is hidden. Okay? In other words, just like the silver-plated gold apple, you see an apple. It's an apple. It's in the shape of an apple. And you see a precious apple. But it's only when you look closer that you start to see, wow, like, this is actually underneath, this is a golden apple. It's even more precious than I thought. It's even more exalted than I thought. It is the next layer of my understanding of the essential truth of this thing. And it only, so to speak, gets better. Right? That's true about our knowledge of God, that we should seek the things that are still hidden from us, we will never know all of what God is, but we continue to reveal new layers of what God is, and that's part of the work of studying mysticism, of studying Kabbalah. It's true of the Torah. The Torah has a very precious and a very important external layer. Precious, we care about it, but also has underneath an internal, a secret, a hidden layer, and it's worth seeing how these things are not just overlaid on top of one another, but they actually, his language is even stronger, they actually are one and the same thing. They actually are just, one is just an extension of the other, okay? And so it is, he says, with the person. And this is quite powerful, especially since his book is also a work, as he names it, of musar, of self-work, self-ethical development, moral development. And so part of what he's saying here is that what we are, you know, in our physical form, it's just like what we know about humans, there's a certain amount that we can know about each other, about ourselves, but all of that is hiding something. That revealed part of us is actually overlaid on some hidden part of ourselves, and that's also what we're investigating. And it's also what we're investigating when we look at Kabbalah, is what is the deepest truth of the human being? What is the secret inner layer of the human being? What is the explanation behind, not just the explanation behind the commandments, but the explanation behind us, behind who we are? What it is that makes us tick? What it is that that is at our essence? And remember, we are, as the Torah is, as God is. All those things are connected. And on some sense, everything is connected. And there's a very meta way in which the work of the Shla, just as a kind of exercise, is a work of connecting all of Jewish thought, an attempt to connect and synthesize mysticism and rationalism. And so he says, just like this book is all connected, everything is connected. And we are all connected. And that is because there is, you know, a oneness to all things. Everything is actually rooted in this ultimate truth, which is God. Okay. Now, I just want to end by saying that that version of the relationship between mysticism and rationalism, which is that they're all really one thing and they can be integrated, I think is very distinct from the mysticism that we encountered in the Maharal. And I said that the Maharal, but we've already named one of the major distinctions, is the Maharal is not openly discussing Kabbalistic texts or concepts. So was he referring to them or not? That's an ongoing debate. But he wasn't openly referring to them, which in itself, if he was familiar with them, is telling you something. If indeed the Maharal is the hidden in the language or revealed, well then, there's something important about keeping things that are totally hidden, you know? That is, if you believe the Maharal actually was a Kabbalist, but put Kabbalah in a digestible, comprehensible language, then part of what the Maharal is saying is that there are certain things that should be kept hidden, that there's an importance, there is a virtue to hiding certain things. And remember that the Maharal even started with the idea that there are certain things that are hidden and unknowable, and certain things that can be investigated, okay? Now, the Maharal is my of these thinkers that we've toured through, it's the Maharal who has made a lasting impression on me, who is, I think, a particularly unique and an important thinker. And if I've done this series to promote any thinker, it's the Maharal, though I'm all of these thinkers are great heroes of mine. But I did say at the outset that there are some pitfalls to the thinking of the Maharal. There's some dangers involved with the thinking of the Maharal. And if the Maharal is, as opposed to the Shla, insisting on the separation of these two realms, the separation of the as he put it in the texts that we look at, the sort of natural realm and the supernatural realm, which he said were two entirely separate realms. So too, the separation between the revealed and the hidden, the separation between the physical and the spiritual, right? The matter and the form. But the pitfall of the danger in the Maharal's way of describing those very separate realms is that there's the potential for that kind of thinking to become totally abstract and not only detached from life and the world and the sort of physical reality, the science of the world, the reason of the world, but also, you know, potentially even a denigration of physical reality itself as a sort of lesser, you know, mere shadow of our existence, something that is not really the essence of things. And there is a sense in which the Maharal is really focused on the pure truth of that upper realm. And, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say he's disinterested in the physical realm. But we did see in the writing of the Kliya Kar, who in some ways was in that same spirit of sort of separating between the higher spiritual realm and the lower physical realm, we saw in the Kliya Kar that there was a real obsession with Olam Haba, with the world to come. And I got another email this week, a very good question, like, you know, isn't this always a dangerous theology when you start focusing on the world to come? Like, this world doesn't matter? Is that really who we are? So there are some dangers there, and I think that the virtue of the Shla and what the Shla offers is the idea that that mysticism, Jewish mysticism, is not some separate realm of secret knowledge that, like, for some reason, you know, should be kept secret, but instead that everything in the world is part of the same system, and that Kabbalah is just the inner essence of everyday Jewish living. By saying that, there's a kind of affirmation that the Shla brings to normative Jewish practice, everyday Jewish living. And his book is like a long and massive way of saying that we should both. We should not only be learning the secrets of Kabbalah, the actual texts and words of the masters and the concepts like the Sfirot, and we should study them and we should know them, but also we should be practicing Jews. We should practice as we've always practiced, and we should study the same texts that we've always studied. We should study the Talmud. You know, when one reads the Arizal, or not the Arizal, but the writings of his student, Reb Chaim Vital, you have a sense sometimes that you're encountering something entirely new. Like, I've never seen anything like this before. This is a kind of a room of Judaism that is, it's like I entered the attic or something. I've never seen what's in here before. Whereas the Shla, though he is citing those texts, is always, as I hope you've seen him do tonight, is always trying to integrate those texts into the material of the Judaism that we all know and love, the Judaism that has come before him, the Judaism not just of the Arizal, but of Maimonides and of the words of Proverbs and of the Shulchan Aruch and of the Talmud. All of it is part of the same system. Okay, so that, I think, is one of the great virtues of the Shla. And I think that in doing that, the Shla sets up the stage. First of all, this work takes a great credit for spreading the sort of spread of Kabbalah throughout Eastern Europe. That is to say, we at the beginning of this period that we're discussing, that was an activity that was taking place in Sfat, but was distinct from the conversation happening in Prague. But I think that it's the Shla. He moves to Israel, but he actually brings that Kabbalistic tradition that goes from Spain into Israel, loops it around to go to spread throughout Eastern Europe. And in that sense, and this is really important, the Shla in many ways is an important figure in setting the stage for Hasidic thought, Hasidic Judaism, and Hasidic writing, which will also be inspired by and interested in and investigating the Kabbalah of the Arizal, but will be looking to put that Kabbalah in language that people can understand and to integrate it into everyday Jewish practice. Okay, so the Shlag gets a lot of credit for that, but I want to say in closing that the Maharal does as well. What the Maharal does, and you just heard me say it when I was describing Hasidic writing, and this tradition sort of goes back to the Baal Shem Tov, the way we think of the Baal Shem Tov, though he never wrote anything down, was that he too was interested in mysticism, but that he was trying to formulate a kind of Jewish mystical life that could be used by the Pashtayid, the simple Jew, the everyday. I'm not holding in all the secrets of Kabbalah, but what does it mean for how I live my life? How can I live out these high spiritual truths in my everyday life? And I think that the Maharal is also deeply influential in what becomes Hasidic thought, in that the Maharal is the one who takes mystical ideas and models for us how mystical language can be put in terms that a rational person, an everyday person, maybe a simple person, can understand. And that in itself is a kind of a revolution, because we are really at this moment in Jewish thought where it seems that there's a tradition, a Kabbalistic tradition, that's sort of veering off from mainstream normative and sort of like rational or comprehensible Judaism to the everyday person. And both the Maharal and the Shlag in different ways set the stage for a kind of integration of those two things, where the mystical does become a part of the rational, the practical, the everyday. And so too, the way that we can express mystical ideas can be formulated in such a way that it resonates, that it enters the ear of even the student in the first day of school, so to speak. Okay, just to end with one last thing, which is that as I think about the Maharal and his capacity for speaking mystical truths in non-mystical language, I gave you the pitgam, the quote that I always heard, which was that the Maharal was hanistar bilashon hanigle. He was the hidden in the language of the revealed. I looked for that quote and I couldn't find it. Like, did the Rav Yitzchak Huttner say this? I don't know. I've heard about it, talked about this way. I couldn't find that quote, but I did find another quote that must be the source for this kind of language. And this is in fact from a Hasidic thinker. And this is the first Rebbe of Vorka, which is not a Hasidus I knew well, but a Hasidic thinker that lived into the 1800s. And this quote, I could find and is attributed to him. So I want to end with this quote tonight, and then we'll take some time for questions if there are any. And he says, Ha'ari HaKadosh, the holy Ari, gile et hasod shebenistar. He revealed the secret in the hidden. V'hamaharal et hanigle shebenistar. And the Maharal revealed the revealed in the hidden. Okay? Now, I just want like, this is it's like very subtle parsing, but I think the language matters here. Because I always heard of the Maharal as described as someone who was the hidden in the language of the revealed, meaning he's really saying secret things, Kabbalistic things, but he's just sort of cloaking it in some language that feels revealed, as in comprehensible. We can understand that. We get what that language means. And if I started talking in Sfirot, you wouldn't get what I was talking about. You'd need to be educated in that system. So that's one way of thinking about the Maharal. But this quote says something a little different, which is that the Arizal, that figure that we've been from Tzvat that we've been contrasting all of, the holy Ari, that's another way of referring to him. The Holy Ari, he is dealing in secrets, in the secret part, the what are the Sfirot, and what is that system? But the Maharal revealed the revealed in the hidden. In other words, this, I think, is a slightly different formulation, which is that there is, in Jewish mysticism, there are particular strains, and there are particular traditions, and there are particular concepts. There is esoterica, in other words. There are the details of the world of the hidden, the discourse of the hidden Torah. But what the Maharal revealed, so to speak, was that in those mystical truths, there are also things that we can all appreciate. We might not all know what the Sfirot are, but we can all, they represent concepts and principles and ideas that if we abstract them and if we render them in, let's say, philosophical language, then we all have access to something in that hidden, maybe there is something in that hidden realm that is hard to know or to access. And if you're a Kabbalist, sure, you're interested in what the Arizal did in finding that hidden layer, the secrets in there, and showing you those secrets. But the Maharal did something different, which was to expose a kind of, so to speak, universal truth that lies in the realm of the hidden. That is to say, what the Maharal was insisting on was that there is truth, that is real truth, that we can appreciate, that is not rational truth. It lies in the realm of the hidden, and usually we speak about that truth only in the very particular and esoteric language, the discourse of the hidden. But the Maharal offers us a way of speaking about those mystical concepts in language that we can all use, and therefore perhaps gives us access to an experience of Jewish mysticism that is for everyone. And when I say, you know, that sounds a little vague, like access to an experience of Jewish mysticism, what does that mean? But, you know, just to give the most obvious example, it is a mystical truth that there is a unity to all things, right? Like, the Kabbalistic language for that is L'shem Yichud Kutshebrichu Shchinteh. Like, may we unify the Holy One and his bride, the Shekhinah. And that's a fascinating image that comes out of a particular tradition. But it's a little hard to understand, like, how is God have a male side and a female side? And why are we talking about these things anyway? That's the realm of esoterica. Whereas the Maharal doesn't use that language, but brings us to understand truths like there is a unity, an ultimate unity to all things. And that's not a rational concept. That's not a provable concept. That's not a philosophical concept. It's a kind of a mystical truth, a truth that we can intuit, a truth that we can come to experience and know, and a truth that perhaps if the Maharal tells us that, you know, there's an experience here that is hidden from us, but if we kind of talk around it, if we talk our way towards it, if we use language that isn't precise and scientific, but that is intuitive and associative, we can get ourselves to those truths. We can come to appreciate the ultimate truths that lie behind our tradition. And even in saying that, I'm borrowing already from the Shla, right? But the Shla, it's the Shla who's saying they lie behind the exposed tradition. I think, though, that the Maharal is saying something different than that, which is that there isn't some secret golden apple hiding behind the silver. It's that if you contemplate the Judaism that is in front of us, mystical truths will emerge from that. If we can just appreciate the essence of the stories and the laws and the texts that we have inherited, then we can begin to see the mystical layer, the divine realm in all of that. And everyone has access to that, and everyone can read that. And I think that's part of what's so important about the Maharal, is that he really does open up a kind of Jewish mystical experience, contemplation, and tradition that is, I'm not saying it's simple, but it is accessible and comprehensible in its language, such that, you know, like any one of us could sit down and start reading the Maharal and trying to wonder about what he means. So that, I think, is the legacy of the Maharal, and it's different from the legacy of the Shlah. But as I said, both of them are important figures, and I think it's underappreciated how important those two figures are for the development of later Jewish thought. Hasidic thought, certainly. I mentioned the founder of Chabad Hasidut, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who described himself as a Shlah Yid, like he read the Shlah, but also was a descendant of the Maharal and really claimed that and saw that as also part of his ancestry and his intellectual ancestry as well. And then there are all kinds of thinkers that I think have been profoundly influenced by the Maharal, who cite the Maharal a lot. And I'll just end by naming a couple of them. I named already the Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, but I think also Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, was a student of the, not a direct student, but mentions the Maharal, and also has a kind of abstract but very mystical vision of the unity of the world. So you can really see the legacy of the Maharal in a figure like Rav Kook. I guess I'll just end by saying it's meant a lot to me because I am not holding in all of those esoteric secrets. I am not a Kabbalist. I do not have knowledge of or access to that whole realm. And with the encouragement of the Shlah, I try to learn more every day and I try to get some of that knowledge. But ultimately, I lean back on the Maharal because even without all of that knowledge, I feel with the Maharal that I have an access to the hidden realm, and therefore a kind of access to God that I can't just think my way through, that I can't just reason my way to, that I can't just sort of prove my way to, that I need someone with the unique language, the unique style, the unique presentation of the Maharal and his sort of intellectual descendants to get me there. So I'm very grateful for having encountered his thought, and I hope that that it's been valuable to you as well.